If you want to take out your Bibles and open up to Genesis chapter 26. Genesis chapter 26. I don't know if you ever feel like you need to be reminded of something. I know the older I get, I feel like I ought to write something down if I really want to make sure I remember it. However, whenever you look here in Genesis 26, you might start to feel like that old French phrase of deja vu, of I feel like we've seen this before. And yet to understand as these things unfold, notice as chapter 26 begins in verse 1. It says, now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. Now you may not remember this great famine they're talking about in the days of Abraham. It's back in Genesis chapter 12. And way back at that time, the famine was so great, that's what made Abram and Sarai decide to go down to Egypt. And if you remember, whenever they went down there, they were rather deceptive in terms of saying, I'm Abram and this is my sister, Sarai. Of course, genuinely a half-sister, but in the other way, his wife. Yet at the same time, he had been given promises about what God would do to bless him, and yet still not complete total trust. And I think we can understand that a little bit. Of times where difficulties come, we trust God, and now a new difficulty comes, and we go, all right, what am I going to do here? How am I going to respond to these things? And so here's this famine. So Isaac goes down to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And Abimelech is kind of a general term, kind of like Pharaoh in terms of with Egypt. And so here's Abimelech, king of the Philistines, and he's sent down to Gerar. And in being there, you may think of another story in the life of Abraham. Whenever in Genesis chapter 20, Abraham and Sarah go to Abimelech. They also go to Gerar. They go to these same places. And you feel like both of these things are here going, do you remember these events in Isaac's father's life? Then notice how this continues on. Verse 2. The Lord, and notice it's all capital letters, so we're talking about the covenant God. He says he's made covenant promises. And so now here in verses 2 through 5, the Lord is going to repeat the same promises that he already made, that Isaac had already heard in Genesis 22. Whenever Abraham went to offer up Isaac on Mount Moriah. At that point in time in Genesis 22, Isaac was about to be offered up, and of course, the angel tells Abraham, you don't have to kill him. He says, of course, the ram's caught in the thicket, they offer up the ram, and then the Lord responds to Abraham again to tell him about these promises that we're about to get repeated in chapter 26. And here's Isaac, who is standing there in the same place and had heard these things before. Now you imagine for Isaac, a little different situation to think, I thought there for a minute my father was going to kill me. So now getting to hear this, and we're a long ways into the future at this point. I mean, that was over 40 years ago. So here he comes through in verse 2. The Lord appeared to him, talking about to Isaac, and said, do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Number one warning. Command, not just a warning. Do not go down to Egypt. That is not for you to go. And then to tell him, stay in the land of which I shall tell you. And by the way, he's about to tell him in the very next sentence. He says, this is where you're to stay. And I want you to notice what gets tied together with this. Verse 3. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. So what's the advantage of Isaac responding to actually stay in this land where God has told him to be? He says, I will be with you and I will bless you. Now, what if he steps outside of the land? What would you expect? He says, you'll be on your own and I'm not going to have anything good to say about you. Because this is a blessing in terms of saying good words. So, here he brings, he says, sojourn in this land, I will be with you and bless you. How does it change your life whenever you have a covenant promise from the Lord saying, I will be with you, it changes everything, doesn't it? It changes the good times. It changes the difficult times. It changes the hard times. It changes the times where you're unsure about what's really going to take place here. I don't know how these things are going to turn out, but I know God's promises. He says, I will be with you and bless you. He says, for to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father, Abraham. You remember what I swore to your father? And we're not going to go back to Genesis 22 and reread it, because he's about to give it again in verse 4. But here's another aspect of this. I'm going to establish the oath. I've already given you my word. So whenever you hear establish, what do you think of? To set it firmly in place. You're about to see the fruits of my promise. You're about to see things start to come together. I don't know if you've ever gone through difficulties in terms of maybe things along the lines of like Romans chapter 8, where we have a promise from God that if we are going to love God and do according to what pleases Him, all things are going to work together for good. And the good that's specifically described there is that we can become conformed to the image, the character of Jesus, His Son. Sometimes in the midst of situations we wonder, how in the world is this going to help me grow? And then all of a sudden you start to see that get established and you see what He's bringing about inside of us. And what do you know about the faithfulness of God? Reliable? Sure? Steadfast? Now, you see what's in place here. He says, I will give all these lands. I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And then he's going to repeat it here in verse 4. You can almost read these things verbatim back from Genesis chapter 22. Then, verse 17. But here, verse 4. He says, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands. And by your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Who's going to do the multiplying? God says, I am. It's not for you. Because does Isaac already have any children at this point? He has two. Remember? You've got Jacob and Esau. They came into being, you see, at the tail end of chapter 25. He says, but I'm going to multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. You talk about an everlasting reminder. How many nights can you go outside and look up and see the stars? Anytime anyone would get leery going, what was that promise again to look up and see the stars? And they go, that many descendants. And here's Jacob and Esau, who are going to become two distinct nations in terms of later, Israel and Edom. He says, I'm going to multiply you. As many as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands. You imagine looking out in Palestine and seeing these places. He says, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. And what's going to come about in these things? This covenant God is going to bring about a blessing upon all the earth. And of course, who's really being referred to here? Here's Jesus. Here's what He's going to do. Because who does His sacrifice open up to? Every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. Every nation. All nations of the earth shall be blessed. Then, notice verse 5. Why? Why did the Lord make this kind of covenant? And once again, if you're back in Genesis 22, where you first get a glimpse of some of these things, this is exactly what He mentioned back there too. He said back in Genesis 22, He says, because you have obeyed my voice, because you had offered up your son, your only son. You see how faithful obedience affects the working of God in our lives. In Genesis 22, the obedience of Abraham is what drew out for God to make this kind of oath to Abraham. And so now the Lord still remembers. And like, here was Isaac at least 40 years ago, perhaps even 60 years ago, maybe even a little bit more than that. But verse 5 says, these things came to be because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. What moved the heart of God? Obedience. I want you to think about this just in terms of, in a parenting sense. As a parent, what really moves you whenever your children are young? Is it not the same thing? Whenever you see them be obedient to what you have told them you desire and want, even whenever it comes at a difficult situation, even when it comes with great striving, even when it comes with going, this is not the easiest thing to do, even in terms of self-sacrifice to do it. Whenever you find out about that kind of obedience, doesn't it move your heart? Doesn't it make you want to respond? Now, here was God with Abraham. I want you to notice back in verse 3, it said, sojourn in this land. In the Hebrew language, the town of Gerar has a meaning. It literally means sojourning. So where do you think Isaac is going to set up camp? Any ideas? You're going to notice how often he's going to be in Gerar. And he's not going to leave too far from there. He knows, I have promises from God here. Now, God's not limited in terms of if he left somewhere else, God has no power there. But this is what's in place. If you were to kick down to verse 17 in the same chapter, notice what happens. And Isaac departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. He's going to make a settlement later on in this same place. Why does he do that? He knows the promises of God. And he knows, if this is what God says, he'll be with me and he'll bless me. If I'm here in this land, this is where I'm going to be. Now, turn over to the New Testament real quick. Look at Ephesians chapter 1. Ephesians chapter 1. Look down at verse 5. In talking about Jesus, or talking about God, it says, he predestined us to adoption as sons through Jesus Christ to himself, according to the kind intention of his will. Do we have boundaries? Do we have certain ways we're supposed to live? Now, I want you to pay close attention to the word predestined here in verse 5. I know we've talked about this in the past, but just as a reminder, this word for predestined in the original language carries with it an extra meaning. And it literally means to set the boundaries. If you think in terms, I just generally think about a baseball field, you have these foul lines that are set out. And hopefully they put those foul lines down before the game begins, right? Because you want to know what are the boundary lines. And to realize, if the ball's hit within there, you know it's fair. Even if it hits the line, it's fair. He says, if it's outside of there, you're not in the boundary lines. It doesn't count. He says, may get a strike for it, but it's not going to count. Won't be considered a hit, won't be a run. And you realize the boundary lines are already set. In the same way that God told Isaac, he says, you need to stay in this land, a land that I'll show you. What about for us? If we step outside of Jesus, are there any promises? None. If you think in these terms, the boundary lines, even within the state of Missouri, we see boundary lines all over the place. County boundary lines, city boundary lines. When you look at Jesus, if our behavior starts to step outside of those boundary lines, and that's where our lives are going to be practiced, in things that are not within imitating Jesus, Can we really share in the same relationship with God anymore? The same blessings abide when you step outside of those boundary lines? It says, He set these lines, He predestined us to adoption as sons through Jesus Christ to Himself according to the kind intention of His will. He says, here's where He said it. To be faithful in Jesus, what does it mean we have? What have we been? We've been adopted as sons. We are part of the family of God. Now, He continues on here saying, specifically, can you have this adoption without Jesus? No, because this happens through Him. Then, He says, according to the kind intention of His will, this is what God desires. He wants to adopt us, but here's the boundary line. It's got to be in Jesus. It can't be anywhere else. These are where the promises of God are. You step outside of that boundary line, there is no covenant promise. Look down a little bit further into verse 11. Well, look at the tail end of verse 10. It's kind of interesting to me how a little bit of Ephesians is broken up. It'll put the beginning of a sentence right at the end of a previous verse. If you look at the very end of verse 10, it says, in Him. Who? In Jesus, Christ Jesus. He says, in Him, into verse 11, also we have obtained our inheritance, having been predestined. Here's that boundary line marker again. He says, having been predestined according to His purpose, who works all things after the counsel of His will. And you realize, can you have an inheritance with God outside of Jesus under this new covenant? No. So once again, our behavior has to look like Jesus's if you want to share in these covenant promises. Now, come back to Genesis chapter 26. So when He makes these statements in verse 3, He says, sojourn in this land and I will be with you and bless you. He says, there'll be blessings. He says, I'll speak good words about you. He says, I'll be with you. Then, notice in verse 5, all these things are coming together because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Under the new covenant, when we walk with Jesus according to His commandments, His laws, His statutes, His charge, don't we find a blessing? Don't we find that God will speak good words about us? Because we're walking out of faithful obedience? And you find this understanding of, you know what, God is with me because I'm going to walk with Him. So often we think of these things, we say, I want God to walk with me. That's the wrong direction. I need to walk with Him. He'll take me where I need to go. He'll protect me as I go. He'll make sure things work according to His will. You notice what we just read in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11 and verse 5. According to His will. His kind intention. Am I here as a servant? To obey? Certainly. Now, so once again, verse 6. So, what's Isaac's response? What'd he do? So Isaac lived in Gerar. It's just, okay, this is where I'll be. If this is where the promises are, this is where I'll stay. I'm not going to go to Egypt. I'm not going to make that mistake. I hear what you're saying, and I'm not going. I'm going to be right here in Gerar. And then all of a sudden, we feel like we're reading the same story from almost 100 years previous. Now understand, in the stories that we know of with Abram and Sarai in Egypt, or with Abimelech, and the stories of Abraham and Sarah in terms of the stories of Abimelech, both ways, like, both of those events took place before Isaac was born. So know that. It's not as if Isaac's sitting there going, I'm going to make the same mistake my father made. But notice verse 7. When the men of the place asked about his wife, Isn't it interesting it introduces her that way? What does it want to make sure we know? Rebecca is his wife. He says, he said, she is my sister. And notice what motivates this to happen. For he was afraid to say my wife, thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebecca, for she is beautiful. Now, I feel for Rebecca because back in chapter 24, verse 16, she was very beautiful. And now, for some reason, she's only described as beautiful. I don't get that. But that's the way it reads. Now, here's the point. Out of faith, what could Isaac truly know? God would be with him, right? But now comes the time to either stand in faith and respond, or to let fear control. And what did he allow to happen? He let fear take over because he's afraid. Now, do we ever do that same thing? Where we go, you know what, I know God's promises said this. And then we go, oh, but I don't know. And fear starts to set in, and we start to do the same thing, don't we? It can happen. And then, if you notice specifically, it says he was afraid. And what's a little unique, it doesn't speak anything about Jacob and Esau in this story, does it? Which is kind of curious to me. So he continues on. He says, the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. Verse 8. It came about when he had been there a long time. How long that is, I don't know. It just says a long time. That Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife, Rebekah. All of a sudden, Abimelech comes to know that is not his sister. I mean, I'll leave that up to your own imagination a little bit. But there's a certain way that you greet your sister, and there's a certain way that perhaps you greet your wife, and they are not one and the same. And so I want you to notice Abimelech's response to this. He sees this take place, and he knows this is not his sister, which also tells you a little bit. Whenever we respond out of fear, is God typically going to say, you know what, I'll just let it keep going all just fine? What do we really need in that moment? We need correction. We need discipline. And sometimes if we don't listen rather quickly, all of a sudden it's our own enemies that correct us. And that's really hard, isn't it? When your enemy says something about you that's cutting, but it's also true, and you go, oh, that hurts. Usually that comes because we didn't listen to it the first time. We've already had opportunities, but now it's got to go further. So, not always, but most of the time. Then verse 9. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, certainly she is your wife! Exclamation point. Abimelech have any doubt? None whatsoever. He doesn't have a question like, are you sure that you didn't tell me? He's like, look, this is your wife. And then, notice what he says next. He says, how then did you say she is my sister? How could you do that? What a wonderful question for Isaac to hear. Because what was working inside of Isaac? It's fear. Sometimes whenever we respond out of fear, I wonder if God wouldn't ask us the same question. How could you do that? How? Then Abimelech goes on. He says, and Isaac said to him, because I said I might die on account of her. Here was my motive. I thought it might cost me my life. Now, notice what Abimelech is aware of. I want you to see the characteristics in terms of here, in terms of morality. I mean, this is a Philistine king. Yet I want you to notice what he recognizes. Verse 10. Abimelech said, what is this you have done to us? What a thought. Look at what your lie has done to us. Have you ever thought about lies never affect just one person? Because whenever you lie, you're lying to somebody, which means more than one person is being affected. So I'm trying to change the way you think about this situation and take it to something that's deceptive. If you remember, one of the very first statements in Ephesians chapter 4, when it talks about putting on the new self, it says, lay aside falsehood. Speak the truth with one another, for we are members of the same body. That's where the new self begins. We're going to have to address that one first. Because if we're going to lie to ourselves and we're going to lie to others in the body, it has a dark effect. And to go, you have to realize this deals with more than just you. And here it was in this situation. Abimelech knew it. He's got some wisdom that God gave him. I'm not sure where he got it from other than that. He says, what is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. You would have caused one of our Philistine men to commit adultery. You would have brought guilt on us, because we would have, some of these men, one of them may have lain with your wife. Huh. Had Isaac thought about that? No. Whenever we lie, are we usually thinking very clearly? No. Are we usually thinking about the outcome beyond just the perception of self? No. And even whenever lies are motivated out of fear, and once again, do children ever lie out of fear? Yeah. Why? What are they afraid of? Punishment, discipline. And so they think, well, let's just heap another one on top of this wrong behavior and let's lie about it. That never helps. Chuck. Right. An assumption that how can we be protected unless we do something deceptive? And to go, here it was. And yet, once again, to trust the Lord. He said He'd be with me. He said He'd bless me. Then, notice how it continues on here. Look at verse 11. So Abimelech charged all of the people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. How serious did Abimelech take this? He says, if you lay hands on Isaac or you lay hands on Rebekah, you will be dead. Well, I bet that made everybody go. But you see the point, right? Was God going to protect Isaac and Rebekah? Yes. What do you really see in this? Because here they are. They've made the wrong move. What do you call it when God takes care of you, even when you make the wrong move? Mercy. Because what do they deserve? They deserve some justice. And yet, God allows them to learn. Sometimes don't we need to learn that? To really understand, here's somebody who's been caught, we say red-handed. God was teaching Isaac, wasn't He? Can you trust me to be with you? Yes. And you realize, it's not because Isaac hasn't learned a lesson. In the days of his father, Abram, later on Abraham, he made the same deception twice. Isaac's only have to go through this once. He's got it figured out. He's not going to be deceptive like this again. But you also realize, you see where these men are starting from. Abraham is going to be deceptive about his wife, Sarah. Isaac is deceptive in lies about his wife, Rebekah, being a sister. Is Jacob going to be deceptive? he's already stolen, I mean, he's already bought the birthright, and later on he's going to be deceptive to defraud and to get the blessing from Isaac. We haven't gotten that far in Genesis yet. But you start to see these things come through and to go, look at where God takes these men, and yet at the end of their lives, what's the relationship going to be like between them and God? Are they not all faithful toward God? And so you realize, here's this sanctification process that we also desperately have to have in order to see God face to face. We have to be refined too. Now, I want you to think about this principle in terms of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Whenever you start really coming together with these things, have you ever heard a phrase in terms of generational sins? Where people talk about things of, these things get handed down from one generation to the next generation to the following generation. Maybe you might say of something like in this instance, you know what? They're deceptive. Abraham was deceptive. Isaac was deceptive. Jacob was deceptive. And you go, the same problems happening generation after generation after generation. Sometimes those same things come along. You go, you know what? They got as filthy of a mouth as their father and grandfather do. You might say, you know what? They're complainers just like their grandma is. Just like their mother was. And you realize, oh. You see these things take place and we start to wonder, is it really something that you can call generational sin? Let's take a minute and really look at this. I don't know if you've ever had this humbling moment. It's not fun if you've experienced it. All of a sudden, here you are with your children, doesn't matter what age they are. And all of a sudden, they do something. And you go, this is a wrong attitude and this is wrong behavior. And you have the realization, I know who they learned that from. They learned that from me. And it's a very humbling moment. Because we look at those things and we go, oh. Like, these situations are very difficult and very humbling. I want you to realize, and I want you to see how God deals with us. Look back at the Gospel of John. Look at John chapter 9. We'll answer these questions. I'll even show you the prevalent thinking of some of the people in the first century. John chapter 9, look at these first three verses. Jesus has just been speaking about how that I am, in other words, I'm the covenant God, I'm right here. And for that, they want to pick up stones and kill him. So as he's running out of the temple, you get to chapter 9, verse 1. It says, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents that he would be born blind? He says, whose fault is this? He says, is it the man who's born blind? Is it his parents? Is that why this happened? Because of the parents' sin? Or is this in and of himself? Verse 3. Jesus gives the answer. He says, it was neither this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. He says, you got it all wrong. Isn't it something? Here's disciples who are wondering, asking these kind of questions, and Jesus says, it's neither. It's not because of his parents' sin. It's not because of this man's sin. Neither one. Now, skip down in the same chapter and look down at verse 30. All of a sudden, of course, this man has been healed by Jesus, given his sight, and all of a sudden they call in his parents to say, is this really your son? Was he born blind? They say, we can really tell you he is our son. How he now sees, we're not going to say, because they're afraid of being put out of the synagogue, because you start going around saying that Jesus did these kind of things and he's the son of God, says, you're going to get the boot. You're not going to be allowed to come to the synagogue services anymore. So they call the blind man who now sees, and again, and have this conversation with him. Look at verse 30. The man, this is the man who was formerly blind. The man answered and said to them, that's the Pharisees, by the way, well, here's an amazing thing that you do not know where he is from, speaking of Jesus. and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners. And notice, this is the man who was born blind. He says, we know that God doesn't hear sinners. He says, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. And who would have asked that question? A man who's born blind. He says, in all the history of the world, this has never happened. He says, but it has now. Verse 33. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And then you realize, verse 34, their response to this, you were born entirely in sins. And are you teaching us? They said, put him out. What is their thought about this man who was born blind? He says, you were born in sin. That's why you were blind. Is that right thinking? No. Has Jesus already given the answer to the disciples? Yes. So, is something go from one generation to the next just vicariously? No. Now, look back at the Old Testament. Look at Ezekiel chapter 18. Ezekiel chapter 18. I wish we had time to go through all of Ezekiel 18. It makes a bigger point, but Ezekiel 18, look down at verse 18. He says, as for his father, because he practiced extortion, robbed his brother, and did what was not good among his people, behold, he will die for his iniquity. He says, you've done these things that are sinful? He says, you'll die for your guilt. That's what iniquity means. Verse 19. Yet you say, why should the son not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity? He says, why does it not get handed down one to the next? He says, if the parents do this, shouldn't their children pay for it? Notice that's the people asking that question. Then, notice how it continues. Verse 19. When the son has practiced justice and righteousness and has observed all my statutes and done them, he shall surely live. Notice, when there's obedience, he says, you'll surely live. It doesn't matter about who your parents were. Then, verse 20. The person who sins will die. The son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. So, here you are as parents. Here are your children. You think, you know what? We strive to put Jesus in front of them. We strive to walk by faith and obedience before them. And then they make a different choice. And you start to wonder, am I the problem? Is this because of me? Am I going to bear this guilt? What do you learn here? He says, children are responsible for themselves. He says, you're not going to bear their guilt. He says, you're responsible for you. He says, you honor me to the best of your ability. As a parent, he says, but the guilt is upon the guilty. He says, and righteousness is upon the righteous. Then, notice how it continues. Look at verse 21. He says, but if the wicked man turns from all his sins which he has committed and observes all my statutes and practices justice and righteousness, he shall surely live. He shall not die. What if a man turns? Does God allow that? Does he accept a repentance and a change? Certainly he does. Notice verse 22. All his transgressions which he has committed will not be remembered against him. Oh, how many stubborn, rebellious children are grateful for that? You mean if I turn to the Lord, I'll be forgiven? And my sins won't be remembered anymore? Oh. He says, because of his righteousness which he has practiced. And notice it's about what you practice. This is what you do on a day-to-day basis. There'll be mistakes. He says, he will live. And then notice verse 23. Do I have any pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the Lord God, rather than that he should turn from his ways and live? Do you realize that God takes no pleasure when wicked, rebellious people die? I think about this sometimes when you maybe read a story, maybe whenever we watch a movie, and all of a sudden the bad guy comes down, and all of a sudden justice hits, and he goes down, and we go, yeah! You know, God doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. He doesn't look at the guilty whenever they die and go, got that one. Because he knows the value of a soul. He knows the price of rebellion and iniquity and guilt. And so you realize, in looking through these things, I want you to see one more passage before the last bell rings. Look over at Exodus chapter 34. There's one more we need to deal with before we can tie it all together. Exodus chapter 34. The Lord has told Moses, you go up on the mountain. He says, I'm going to cover you in the cleft of the rock with my hand, and I will proclaim my name before you. Exodus 34, look down at verses 6 and 7. It says, then the Lord, the covenant God, passed by in front of him, being Moses, and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness and truth, covenant love and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. I thought we just said in Ezekiel that he doesn't take this out on the next generation. Here is where the rubber meets the road. When the next generation chooses to do the same things as the prior generation, what are they going to receive? The same outcome. And whenever the next generation, the third generation, learns those same corrupt attitudes and behaviors, what are they going to receive? The same thing. Fourth generation? Same thing. So understand this, and don't leave without this thought. We know what it's like to be so humbling whenever you see your children make the same wrong behaviors and mistakes. Do you see the wonder of whenever you are men and women of faith leading a home, and all of a sudden you realize, you get to see your children, and they start to make decisions of faith. They start to become children who say, you know what, I want to be last. I want to do what's good for someone else. When you see them decide, it's better to do what's right than to receive some monetary gift for doing what's wrong. And whenever you see those things, all of a sudden, it's not humbling in the sense of, oh no, this is a horrible thing. You go, this is a beautiful moment. It's a beautiful moment. And you get to watch faith grow, and you get to see it refined. And so realize, when you see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you see them go through some similar things. And yet at the same time, you also see them respond to faith later on. And you see how God deals with them to protect them and to show them mercy in the midst of those moments, because we're going to turn back to obedience to God. And so realize, there's not this idea of generational sin just because your parents did something that now you have to do it. It's always a choice and choosing and realizing even the best parent of all time has children who rebel. Because God is the only perfect parent. And look at some of His own children. And you realize, it's up for us to put what's best in front of our children. He says, but they have to make a decision whether they're going to honor God or whether they're going to rebel against Him. And that is very difficult for every parent in terms of those things. Realize, that's what God has done with us as His own children. All right. Next week, come back. And we'll keep on plugging along in Genesis chapter 26.